The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Got Democracy? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This election day, there are international observers here in the U.S. monitoring the vote and spreading the same message they would anywhere else in the world.
Our mission is just to send out the message that voting and having good regulations for voting is an important thing. That's the goal of democracy.
Also, we hear what made the late Marie Colvin such an extraordinary journalist.
This real need to be right in the heart of the story, that was what she felt more than anything.
Plus, if you've been considering buying a new Persian rug, the seller says those new U.S. sanctions on Iran are going to cost you.
They are making American buyers pay more for it.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today is the day millions of Americans go to the polls to have their say in the midterm elections. The big picture, today's vote will be seen as a referendum on President Donald Trump's first 2 years in office. When you come right down to it, the midterms are really a long list of offices that are mostly down ballot, from the U.S. Senate to state and local positions. One question on the minds of some voters, will my vote even count? A question that we've heard on the minds of people in places like Zimbabwe, Myanmar, and Iraq. In the 2018 midterms across the U.S., there are international observers in place, watching to see if voting today is free and fair. The World's Rupa Shenoy has been spending time with several of them in Georgia, where voter suppression has been a big concern.
The international observers drive straight from the airport to the Georgia Secretary of State's office in downtown Atlanta. They arrive in wrinkled suits. There are two of them invited by Georgia officials, and they're here to see State Elections Director Chris Harvey. It's Pascal Kolber's first time monitoring in the U.S. He's a pastor and a member of German Parliament.
He should answer the questions we have about how the process works here, stuff like that.
The observers can't talk about anything, even vaguely political. It was unusual for them to allow me to ask a few questions along the way. And they're not supposed to judge. Kolber says it's impossible to compare this election in Georgia to others across the world because elections are different everywhere. Monitors are just supposed to listen, understand the local election system, ask questions, and record details.
Hey, Chris Harvey.
I'm not allowed to follow as they're ushered inside. For 50 minutes in the waiting area, calls come in. People are asking about their polling places or if they can still register to vote. Other conversations sound more awkward. Dennis Carboni, taking the calls, repeats himself again and again.
Well, that's all I can do for you, ma'am. Ma'am, they're not available right now. That's why I'm saying I can take your name and number down, so when they are available, I can...
People are upset with Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, and the Republican candidate for governor in today's election. Thousands of voters had their registrations held up because they didn't exactly match records on file. Democrats and civil rights activists call it voter suppression. Kemp says he's being thorough. He's accused Democrats of hacking the election.
Thank you very much. I mean, basically, the explanations we got was... Clear.
The other monitor, Soren Sondergaard, is a shipbuilder and a member of Danish Parliament who's been a monitor for years.
We also, of course, ask about the machines, and he said that, they could not guarantee that it not could be hacking of the machines.
But Sondergaard says elections officials told them the voting machines aren't networked together or connected to the web as a way of guarding against hacking. He says local officials seem confident about their plans, but what counts is what happens on election day.
The decisive thing is whether the reality corresponds with theory, huh?
The U.S. agreed to international election monitors in 1990 at a meeting in Paris where a bunch of countries created what's called the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, a way to help knit the world back together after the Cold War. Observers are supposed to look for fairness, transparency, and a lack of interference from political parties. But they know they may not be seeing the whole picture.
We don't know whether what we have observed is the truth or only the exceptions from the rule.
And the IDs out and ready. IDs out and ready.
This morning, the monitors start visiting polling places before they open. It's raining.
We got up maybe about, start praising and worshiping maybe about 5.
Jeffrey Banks and his wife Valerie stand in a line outside a downtown polling place.
We was praying for God to put it in people to make the right decision. Whichever way it swings, let the person whoever gets elected, let them do the right thing by everybody, but always have the people in mind.
Local volunteer monitors are here too, and they say that so far things are moving smoothly. One of them, Aklina Kondekur, is an attorney with the Georgia ACLU.
If we do see something, we write it down. That's the basis of our work here. We make sure we write it down and we investigate it afterwards.
The international monitors agree things are going mostly well.
But there was obviously some confusion about where some people have to vote.
Because the election districts have recently been redrawn. Sondergaard says people who were in the wrong place were given provisional ballots. He also noticed there were 6 staffers instead of the expected 8, perhaps contributing to the long line, a line that surprised Coburn.
The people waiting 30 minutes, I've never waited voting in Germany for 30 minutes, but I know that in other places it's even longer, and I realize that the people seem to be okay with it.
The most important thing, Kober says, is that they were allowed to ask questions, and officials answered readily, showing cooperation.
Because there are other countries in the world where people are not allowed to vote and where democracy is not in place, and it's just to send out the message that voting and having good regulations for voting is an important thing.
And the people will be the ones who really decide if this was a fair election. Sondergaard says all monitors can do is record what they see and contribute to an overall national report.
We are not a judge. We are not a super national state imposing things on people. So, but we can say we think this should be considered. And then people in the U.S. can, if they think it's a good idea, can put a pressure for that. But that's up to basically the population in the U.S.
The monitor's last report after the 2016 elections found that, quote, fundamental freedoms were respected. But at the same time, quote, millions of citizens were disenfranchised and unable to vote. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Atlanta, Georgia.
International election inspectors and voters on the ground in Atlanta. We've got photos. Go to theworld.org. Higher than usual voter turnout in today's midterms could end up making all the difference. And that got us thinking. Some countries have mandatory voting laws. That used to be the case in Chile. Up until a few years ago, voting was mandatory there. To learn more, we turn to Cristobal Rovira Kaltwasser. He's a political science professor at Diego Portales University in Santiago, Chile's capital. He says the old mandatory voting system was put in place after dictator Augusto Pinochet was ousted in 1989.
And at that period of time, the electoral system established mandatory voting, but at the same time established that voters need to register. This means if I wanted to vote in 1989, I need to go to register. And after that, I will have the right to vote in all elections, but that would be mandatory. But all those who didn't register, they didn't have the right to vote. And one of the consequences of that system is that turnout levels have been low since 1989 in Chile. This is the reason why in 2012 we have the reform to get rid of mandatory voting, because in theory, this should help to improve the levels of political participation, but it didn't happen in practice.
So in 2012, mandatory voting was dropped. Tell me about the push to make that happen.
Well, at that period of time, Michelle Bachelet was the president of the country. She belongs to the center left. And her idea was to, first of all, get rid of this process of registration, which means everybody could just go the day of the polls and vote. Everybody was in favor of that. The whole discussion was whether we should also get rid of mandatory voting and move towards voluntary voting or not. My impression is that she, as a president, and also the people working with her, were very in favor of voluntary voting because it sounds very liberal. Everybody has the right to vote. If you don't want to vote, this is just your personal decision. And at the same time, polls were showing that most Chileans, around 70 to 80% of the population, were saying if there is going to be a reform, it should go towards voluntary voting. And that is what happened at the end of the day.
So as a political scientist, what does that apathy tell you about democracy in Chile?
Well, funnily enough, before the reform was implemented in 2012, the level of political participation was more than 50%. If you look at the last elections that we had in 2017, a bit less than 50% of the population went to the polls. And if you compare that probably with the US, you will tell me, well, that's normal. But in the case of Chile, that was not normal, because at the beginning of the transition to democracy, more than 90% of the population voted. So it's very clear that voluntary voting didn't help to improve political participation. The levels of apathy in Chile are very worrying. There is a big chunk of the population that just doesn't care about politics at all. But also at the same time, we have growing levels of protest. I mean, social movements are getting very important in Chile, which means there is a big chunk of younger population that don't necessarily are keen on participating via elections, but they are keen on participating via demonstrations. I don't think that this is good news for the political system, because I'm fine with having protest, but I also think that as relevant as protest, and probably more relevant than protest, is participating through the normal channels of democratic systems to elections. And this is not happening in the Chilean case.
Political science professor Cristobal Rovira Kaltwasser at Diego Portales University in Santiago, Chile. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's circle back briefly to the midterms here. Immigration has been a big point of discussion. I've got the world's Monica Campbell, who covers immigration for us. She's at her base in California. Monica, President Trump made immigration his focus down the home stretch in this campaign. What are you looking out for as election results come in tonight?
There are a lot of issues that immigrants and the immigrant community put at the top of their list, and it can vary depending on where they are in the country. It can be about healthcare, it can be education, it can be the economy and jobs. And what I'm keeping in mind is to not think of the immigrant community as a monolith. We want to make sure that we don't kind of fall into the same traps of framing the immigrant vote and the Latino vote in particular the same way. You're not going to have 2 years go by and have radical change among an entire swath of, you know, potential voters.
Point taken. When it comes to some of those issues you mentioned, though, like healthcare and the economy, as you speak with Latino voters around the country, what are you hearing when it comes to those issues?
A lot of people in the Latino community are among the group that have the least access to quality healthcare. You still have a lot of young people dropping out of high school. I mean, it's gotten a little bit better, but really you have a real disparity between how a young Latino woman or man will do in high school compared to their white counterpart. So education is a big deal. And we know when a lot of people bring their families to the United States, one of the motivating factors is, I want my kid to get an education, because the idea is that the United States has this gold standard when it comes to education vis-a-vis other countries, or at least the ones they're coming from. Sometimes there's a rude awakening when they come to the United States and when it comes to education. That's a big issue among a lot of people in immigrant and in the Latino communities as well.
Last question, Monica. Where are you going to be tonight as the polls close in California where you are?
Tonight I'm going to Hayward, which is a little bit outside San Francisco, and I'm going to be with a family, two sisters. One, she just got her green card. She's from Mexico, and her sister, also from Mexico, who has DACA, so the program created by Obama to protect people who came when they were quite young to the United States from deportation. And then one of the sisters, her husband is from Pakistan. He's a U.S. citizen. So I believe he's going to be the only person in the House that voted apart from myself. And then also you have the sister's father, who lives in another part of California, and he's undocumented and he may be facing deportation. So it's a family where you have a lot of immigration issues front and center. But I'm also interested in hearing from them, you know, what else is on their mind when it comes to the election.
Yeah, that should be an interesting evening. The World's Monica Campbell, thanks very much.
You're very welcome, Marco.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you know anything about American war reporter Marie Colvin, you know that she wore an eye patch. You may also know what happened in 2012.
Two Western journalists, the American foreign correspondent Marie Colvin and the French photojournalist Remy Ochlik, have been killed in the Syrian city of Homs.
Marie Colvin covered just about every major conflict on Earth, starting from the mid-1980s on. Now her life is the subject of a feature film called A Private War.
I hate being in a war zone.
I also feel compelled to see it for myself.
Because you're addicted to it.
But Hollywood can only tell you so much about Marie Colvin.
The movies, it's always very difficult to do what we do as journalists because, you know, when we're out there, we don't really sort of go around proclaiming things. We just ask questions. But I do feel that Rosamund Pike captured something of Marie, and actually it's quite spooky watching her.
That's Lindsay Hilsum of Britain's Channel 4 TV. She was a former road buddy of Colvin's. Hilsum didn't play a role in the production of the new film. Instead, she's written a book about her colleague, and in it she recounts a final phone call she had with Colvin from a town in Syria under siege.
Lindsay, she said, is the worst we've ever seen. I said, what is your exit strategy? And she said, that's just it. We don't have one. I'm working on it now. And that was the last conversation I had with her. And then I handed her over and she did an interview for Channel 4 News about the terrible, terrible things that she was seeing.
There's been absolutely ferocious shelling this morning, starting at about 6:30 in the morning. I'm on a street. Half the houses on this street have been hit. Including the one I'm in that lost the top floor. The Syrians are not allowing civilians to leave. Anyone who gets on the street, if they're not hit by a shell, they're sniped.
And a few hours after that, Syrian troops fired a missile into the building Colvin was in, and she died. How did you two meet?
It was in the late 90s, and war had broken out between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and we found ourselves in Djibouti, which is the hottest place on Earth. And it was a normal situation where all sensible people are leaving somewhere, and there's a, what H.R. Mencken called a little bunch of madmen. That's the journalists who are trying to get in. So there was a plane flown by Ukrainian pilots for a Somali airline, which was bringing business people and so on out and taking journalists in. And as we walked across the tarmac, which was kind of melting, we started to walk together and we sat down next to each other. And as the plane taxied down the runway, we saw two things going past the window. They were the pilots' T-shirts, which they had taken off because it was so hot. And we looked into the cockpit, and yep, they were flying bare-chested. And as the plane took off, all the TV gear, which they had put at the front and not secured, slid down the aisle. And Marie and I got the giggles like girls in school. And we were so sure we were going to die, that we were going to plunge into the Red Sea. We just couldn't stop laughing. That's when we became friends.
Yeah, well, that is a bonding episode for sure. How soon did you discover what set Marie Colvin apart as a reporter? What did you see?
Well, I saw that she always went in further and stayed longer. Frequently, I would hear Marie was around on a story, but I would never see her because she was way in and she always stayed a long time to get really to the root of everything. And so I think a lot of the journalists, we were jealous of her. But also, you know, she was braver than the rest. And that was another thing that really distinguished Marie. She really was committed to the story and committed to telling the story of the victims of war.
Her first taste of conflict was in Libya. It was 1986, and the U.S. and Ronald Reagan were about to bomb Tripoli and Benghazi. Muammar Gaddafi wasn't talking to anyone, but he did talk to Marie Colvin. Describe what happened.
She was pretty young at this point and pretty naive, but she had a contact through somebody and she just pestered and pestered and pestered. And everybody knew that Gaddafi liked to talk to young women and he was quite predatory, so she had to kind of negotiate that carefully. The other thing was Marie loved clothes, so Gaddafi was a gift. You know, there he was in his, you know, leopard skin slippers and his long gold cape, or, you know, those ridiculous uniforms with all the medals across. And so she described all of those things in detail. But she said that it was one of the weirdest experiences ever, because she did a series of interviews with him then, and there was one where she asked him what he was feeling about the fact that the Americans were about to bomb, and he said, "How do you know that?" And she was like, "Well, everybody knows that." And then he rushed across the room and turned on the BBC World Service as if she'd just given him some state secret. But he was kind of fascinated by her.
In a later interview with Gaddafi, she was summoned to meet him in a tiny, dark room with imitation wood paneling. There's only a curtain separating this room from a bedroom, and he puts his hand on her thigh. I mean, how did she deal with that advance and any advances from predatory men she encountered on the job? There must have been a few of them.
Yeah, well, I don't really know. She escaped. Somehow or other, she managed to escape.
You write in your book, Marie and her editors had invented a myth for her, an identity that they promote. Do you think her editors may danger her brand? And was that fair to her?
Oh, definitely they did. I mean, Marie wore this eye patch after she lost the sight in her left eye. She had one with rhinestones on for parties. And
really?
So, you know, so she kind of bought into her own brand, as it were. And I think that that was where it became really difficult, because she had that image on the outside. And what I write about in the book is how she didn't always feel that on the inside. Mm. And increasingly, she felt vulnerable. And the losing of the sight in her eye, you know, she would make a joke about it. You know, when her friend said, oh, you know, you should have got more insurance money than they gave you. She said, yeah, I should have lost an arm. Then I would have got more money. You know, she was always like that. She would make jokes like that. But it did make her feel insecure. And she got terrible nightmares after that incident. So that, I think, was the real problem, not being able to marry up the image which other people had of her and which she also had of herself with that vulnerability she felt inside.
Well, your book, In Extremis, is so gripping because Colvin is a flawed character. You describe how she sometimes cut corners in her journalism. She got off a plane to meet some conservative Muslim Chechens, and she had been drunk on the plane, and then her final story in Syria. How do you describe what she was doing in Homs? Was it bravery? Was it bravado? Was it something else?
She believed in some way that when she had left Homs after writing her first story, that she had abandoned the people there. She felt that she had abandoned the women and children in the widow's basement, which was the last story she had done for the Sunday Times. So she felt a commitment to that story, and that was why she went back in. She was also an incredibly competitive journalist. The photographer she was with, Paul Conroy, you know, he's a former soldier, he's a former para. I mean, this, you know, this guy is brave. He said, we've really got to get out, we've got to leave because it's just too dangerous. And at that point, some French and Spanish journalists turned up. And so Marie turns to Paul and she says, so do you still want to leave now, the Euro trasher here? And so, you know, that's Marie, this mixture of incredible competitiveness, real commitment to the story and the people, and this need to be, she said, would we have covered Srebrenica from the suburbs? This real need to be right in the heart of the story. That was what she felt more than anything.
Lindsay Hilsum's new book is In Extremis, The Life and Death of the War Correspondent Marie Colvin. Lindsay, thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure, Marco.
Marie Colvin appeared several times on The World. This is from her final interview with us from Misrata, Libya, as Gaddafi's missiles were launching.
It is very dangerous. I mean, it has to be said. And I thought I wanted to stay because the people of Misrata deserve a voice. We need to report, and I don't want to sound grand or anything, but report to the world what is going on here. That was very important to me.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. There is a new culinary attraction in Midtown Manhattan.
Good morning, Manhattan!
Jolly Bee!
That's right!
The Jollibee fast food chain is well known to Filipinos, but now Jollibee wants to go mainstream in New York City. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. While we've all been busy talking about politics and the midterm elections here in the U.S., people in Iran are talking about the economy, their wallets. And that's because U.S. sanctions on Iran are snapping back into place. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
The Iranian regime has a choice. It can either do a 180-degree turn from its outlaw course of action and act like a normal country, or it can see its economy crumble.
From Iran, there's been a tone of defiance.
البته در گذشته هم دولت‌های قبلی آمریکا با همین سر و صداها.
That's Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif saying, quote, President Trump's predecessors also began crafting their Iran policy with similar bravado, but came around to accepting and respecting the reality of Iran as they became more experienced in office. To break all this down for us, we called up Bahman Kalbasi. He's actually in El Paso, Texas, covering the U.S. midterms for the BBC's Persian service. Kalbasi took a break to speak with us about what's playing out back in Iran, and I asked him to begin by explaining how the sanctions work.
Well, the main goal of these sanctions, the stated goal, is to cut Iran's revenue from the sale of crude oil. But it goes far beyond that. It's basically suffocating any relationship that Iranian financial institutions and banks have with their counterparts outside of Iran. It also making it much harder for medicine, food to be imported into Iran. as well as Iran's aviation industry, not only sanctioning the major airlines, they also, for the first time, sanctioned individual planes so they couldn't get service if they fly to another country, whether it be it for just simple refueling or other transactions that any airline would have with the host country's airport.
So a lot to unpack there. Let me just ask you quickly, what does the White House hope the sanctions are going to achieve?
What the White House says and what the White House wants seems to be there's a gap in between. They say they want to see the change of behavior of Iranian government as far as their malign activity, as they call it, is concerned. But what it really wants, and most analysts looking at it, is fermenting the level of dissatisfaction among Iranian people so they will rise up and change the government.
So I'd really like to know, on a day-to-day level, what effect the sanctions will have on the Iranian people. You mentioned food and medicine. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said food and medicine won't be affected. So what's real here?
While nominally food and medicine are exempt, in reality, when you want to import any kind of medicine or drugs, you would have to have a financial relationship to the company that is selling you these drugs. When the financial institutions, the banks in Iran, cannot transact with other banks, you're basically frozen out of being able to have any major import of drugs into Iran. So medicine has become scarce already. So many institutions that are dealing with everything from chemotherapy to everything else are warning that we're talking about 3-4 months before we run out of stocks.
Have you been speaking with people inside Iran, and what are they telling you?
Constantly, and we see them posting on social media. You have historically an Iranian middle class who is very interested in opening up to the world. It voted accordingly in 2005 to bring the current administration, the moderate Rouhani president, to strike a deal and bring Iran out of that isolation, which is what it did. So they are now watching a United States government that has violated a deal that Iran was abiding with.
And specifically, what pain are you hearing from those people inside Iran about sanctions?
People who are doing everything from, you know, master program to a PhD all the way to a laborer, losing of jobs, factories closing, not being able to get a simple admission to university in the United States, not being able to get a visa to the United States because of the travel ban. It's an all assault on everything that a middle-class Iranian would like to do.
Finally, Bahman, you're in Texas and El Paso. What does BBC Persian make of these intense midterm elections, generally speaking? What are you relaying back to the audience in Tehran the same week that U.S. sanctions on Iran take hold again?
It is maybe the first time in a midterm election is resonating outside of the United States because of what it means about U.S. policy vis-a-vis Iran. If Democrats win, the interpretation would be that America is not on board with these policies, and there's more hope that in 2 years there will be a different administration that will act differently. So what we're telling our audiences is watch for the results, and from that one can come to conclusions in terms of how lasting the current foreign policy is going to be.
Bahman Kalbasi with BBC Persian speaking with us from El Paso today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
A rough road ahead for people in Iran. Sanctions are also a blow to business people dealing in products from Iran, including business people here in the U.S. Victor Mashihi, for example, sells anti-carpets.
I understand why they're doing this, but to put embargo on antique Persian rugs is totally wrong.
My WGBH colleague Philip Martin sat down with Mashihi recently near his store in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Philip, tell us who Victor Mashihi is and how you met him.
Victor is a carpet salesman, an antique carpet salesman, and I met him because I was looking in a storeroom in Chevy Chase just across the border from D.C. at 12 midnight. I had just passed by this room and saw these exquisite carpets, and I was just...
You were in the market for a carpet?
I can't afford a carpet, but I was in the market for looking. And so I'm looking at this carpet, just looking, and this fella comes around the corner. He says, "You like it?" I said, "Absolutely." He says, "Beautiful, isn't it?" I said, "Yes, it is." He says, "My name is Victor. I'm the owner of this space." Huh? And at 12 midnight, he opens up his doors. 12 midnight, store had long closed around 7 o'clock, to show me a stranger... carpet, and not because he knew I could buy anything, because I told him from the very beginning I couldn't. I'm a reporter, and I work right. for public radio, and so that was out. And so he showed me these exquisite carpets, some about 1,000 years old. Wow. Some that had been in palaces in Europe and in expensive homes in the United States. Carpet that had been originally, again, from Persia, now known as Iran. And it was something that he just loves, adores, and was willing to show a stranger because this is something that is dear to his heart.
Does he have roots in Iran?
He's from Iran. He came to the United States in 1975. Hasn't been back since then, interestingly.
So super accommodating at midnight, and I assume that you got into a nice conversation with him. Did he talk to you about how Iranian-made rugs are going to be affected by these new U.S. sanctions?
It's something that it struck him very hard, and he was emotional over it. And he says that people like himself are going to be hurt, but he says carpet makers, those everyday men and women, but mainly men in Iran, are the ones who will be mainly hurt. Over a million of these people who make carpets. He, of course, will suffer as well, but that wasn't his main focus.
Yeah, and what is the kind of exact nature of the economic calculation here? That with sanctions, he'll be cut off from the supply of authentic Persian carpets from Iran, and therefore he won't be able to sell them anymore? Is that it?
So he's being hurt indirectly, because the importation of Persian rugs also means Persian rugs bought almost anywhere. So many of the ones that are most valuable and which he deals with aren't coming directly from Iran.
For over 100 years, these antique rugs, they've been out of Iran. They've been bought by various people from around the world, whether Europe or Americans or Asians or whatever, years and years ago, and they own these and change hand anywhere between 1 to 100 times these rugs.
But they can't be imported into the United States per the sanctions. He flew to Europe and other countries in August, and he purchased just hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of Persian rugs in order to have them in his store.
He was anticipating these sanctions.
That's right. That's right. He was anticipating the sanctions. And if he had waited until September 29th, which would have been the cutoff date, it would have been too late. And he would have basically found himself heavy in penalties. And he talks about that as well.
The business of rugs, like any other business, is about supply and demand. So by sanctioning, the price should go up because they'd be less available. Therefore, indirectly, by sanctioning antique rugs entering U.S., they are making American buyers, people in U.S., pay more for it.
All right. So it sounds like it's not real clear whether he could make money off the sanctions or not.
Well, you're right. He could make money off the sanctions, but he would have a finite supply of rugs. He's going to run out eventually.
Yeah. Reporter Philip Martin with our partners here at WGBH. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Still on the business tip, the opening of a new fast food joint, not usually a big deal. Try telling that to fans of Jollibee. Jollibee is a Filipino chain that's become a worldwide brand by catering to the Filipino diaspora. Now it's looking to dive into the American mainstream with a brand new restaurant just off Times Square. Rosalind Tordesillas was at the opening.
So far, so cold.
Rafael Sullivan's been out on the sidewalk in the rain for 2 hours. Just 11 more to go. Jollibee is opening its first location in Manhattan, and it's celebrating with some big offers. The first 40 in line get a bucket a month of their signature fried chicken for a year.
I'm actually 21st. I get Chicken Joy for a year. Yes, I do.
Rafael grew up in the Philippines and is now a student at the University of Connecticut. He planned to come here anyway, but he jumped on an earlier train when he saw on social media that someone had already started the line. That someone was Justin Callen and Faye Javier, tech consultants from Brooklyn. The couple showed up at noon on Friday for the Saturday 8 a.m. opening with rain gear and camping chairs.
I'm actually on a call right now in EST.
Yeah, listening to calls and got our computer set up with our hotspots and everything. So
Jollibee came to the U.S. in 1998. But some people thought the devotion of homesick Filipinos was all it had going for it. One Filipino blogger even said, Jollibee probably isn't appealing enough to cross over to a non-Filipino clientele. And yet...
Good morning, Manhattan! A jolly morning to all! Jolly morning!
This location is the 42nd in North America, and it's a major play for the brand, just off Times Square, it's aiming for the mainstream. Of course, this Jollibee still trades on Pinoy pride and nostalgia. Here's Rafael again.
Oh, I've been eating Jollibee since I was a kid. Jolly spaghetti, yum burger, burger steak, you name it. So it's part of my culture, and I don't want to let Filipinos down, the homeland, you know?
Faye has her own memories.
Growing up, I had braces, and every time it's my comfort food after getting my braces adjusted and I'm in pain. So next to my dentist is a Jollibee, so I would always go there with a French fries and a sundae and dip the French fries in the sundae, and it'll make me feel better.
And Faye got Justin hooked. Justin is actually first in line. He's Italian-Irish-American, a gift to the Jollibee marketing team.
Our vision is to be one of the top five restaurant companies in the world.
Jose Miñana is Jollibee's group president for North America. He says their customers in California are about 80% Filipino and about 70% in areas like Chicago and Florida. But here, they'll have to target more non-Filipinos. And the streamlined menu is key.
So it's a chicken joy, and then we have our Jolly Spaghetti, and then our peach mango pie.
Thank you. Have a jolly day.
Chicken joy is what got Matthew Sterner in the door in Jacksonville, with no help from any Filipinos.
Walked in one day, tried it out, and then every day since then, I just stopped there on my way home.
Matthew was third in line today, and Jollibee's counting on walk-ins like him. They think peach mango pie with real Filipino mangoes will be a hit. The spaghetti with a slightly sweet red sauce, ham, and hot dogs? That could be confusing for newbies.
To the reaction that I can't get over this spaghetti, don't think of it as a spaghetti then.
Paolo Espanola is a food blogger and podcaster. He relates the spaghetti reaction to how Filipinos are still misunderstood here.
Well, what are they? Like, you look Asian, but you have my last name is Espanola, and they're like just confused. I think this is actually an advantage. The fact that we feel so familiar to many other cultures at the same time foreign, I don't see that as a bad thing at all, that it is hard to categorize. Because the act of categorization, you're immediately drawing a boundary.
Paolo was born and raised in Saudi Arabia among other Filipino families. His mom is of Chinese descent. He did high school and college in the Midwest and lives in New York now. He's found that food is great for blurring boundaries.
When I see something that's very like unexpected in another person's cuisine, I'm like, how did that get there? And then they go into this whole like, oh, these guys came to our country and this. For me personally, I think it presents an opportunity that it is opening in my hand to open up that conversation.
Do good things to please our folks. How about that for a conversation starter? You could get into a really deep discussion about Filipino culture just from that verse. For the World, Rosalind Tordesillas, New York.
Another election story now. It's about how a divisive election campaign can split not just a country, but families. This one's from Brazil, where they just went through one of the most polarized presidential elections in recent history. Catherine Osborne tells us about one woman in Rio de Janeiro who's struggling with the personal fallout.
1 week after Brazil voted in the far-right Jair Bolsonaro as their next president, I met up with a young banker.
My name is Raquel. I'm 35 years old.
We're at a cafe in Rio. Raquel asked not to use her last name. She's worried about online harassment because of her political beliefs. She voted for the left-wing candidate, Fernando Haddad. He lost in the runoff.
Haddad não foi a minha opção no primeiro turno.
She says Haddad wasn't an ideal choice, but he served as a rebuke to Bolsonaro, who she considers racist, sexist, and authoritarian. Her mother voted for Bolsonaro. She and her mom have voted differently in the past, but this time, it became impossible to talk with her mother about all this. Her mother wouldn't talk to me either. But Raquel says the main challenge for her was a barrage of false information her mother read and shared on WhatsApp and Facebook. Raquel says her mother is an educated woman, so she finds it hard to understand how she could believe conspiracy theories, like the claim that Brazil's election machines would be rigged to convert votes to the left.
So you have two almost completely different narratives of the reality.
That's political analyst Marco Bastos. He says the two narratives in the Brazilian election relied on fear more than facts. The left played up Bolsonaro's praise of Brazil's dictatorship. Bolsonaro pushed his narrative of a communist threat through a social media following he had been building for years.
The way Bolsonaro could get public support was by being very polarizing.
During the campaign, Bolsonaro said he would wipe his political opponents off the map. That helped set the tone for an election in which dozens of Brazilians physically assaulted opponents on the street. At home, family feuds have broken out and Christmas celebrations have been canceled. And even after winning, Bolsonaro continues to verbally attack his critics and the media.
He needs this enemy to keep his troops with him.
Bastos says that leaves it to the rest of society to conduct a healthy political dialogue, especially with people who voted differently. And he thinks it's possible, with some effort. So does Raquel, the banker. Since August, she's even been dating someone with very different political views.
And my name is Hernan, I'm 33.
Hernan works at a pharmaceutical company. They met on Tinder, and they didn't talk about politics on their first date.
Acho até porque quando você quer conquistar alguém, você evita temas polêmicos, né?
When you're trying to win someone's heart, he says, you avoid controversial topics. But it was election season, and it wasn't long before Raquel sent him a quiz about which candidate matched his values.
E aí foi em cima dessa agenda liberal, econômica, que eu achei que era melhor essa mudança.
Hernan says his main political issue is the importance of free market economics. He was so unhappy with the way the Workers' Party had governed for 13 years, he told Raquel, that if they made it to the runoff, he would vote for any opponent, even Bolsonaro.
Pensando assim, meu Deus, como assim? Como assim uma pessoa que
oh
tem
my God, she remembers thinking, how is this possible?
Ideias violentas, agressivas.
Raquel thinks Bolsonaro's ideas are violent, aggressive, and racist. So they talked about it. And Hernan says he agrees with that view.
De melhora da economia, de redução da fiscal, de taxa de juros.
But he thinks economic stability would help resolve the social problems Raquel cares about. The couple has discussed the election and now the new administration constantly. And they both say that's made them respect each other more rather than less. What's important, says Hernan, is to listen to the other person and make sure everyone is basing their ideas on trustworthy sources. The couple say they recognize the trade-offs in their decisions and that they're open to changing their minds.
Ainda não passei pela experiência de mudar.
That hasn't happened yet, they say. But still, they've decided not to get angry.
Essa segregação, essa briga só é real entre nós.
The division and fighting is only real between us, common people, says Raquel. The politicians will become allies tomorrow if it benefits them. Raquel still has not spoken to her mother about politics since the election.
E eu espero que em breve isso já se normalize, mas...
But she hopes she will be able to soon. For The World, Catherine Osborne, Rio de Janeiro.
So an internal family feud in Brazil. When it comes to politics, we're no strangers to that here. We'll soon know whether these midterms just add to the problem. Right now, though, can we just hit pause on political divisions? I heard this song the other day from a band out of Colombia that I love. Don't let their French name confuse you. This is the latest from Monsieur Periné. Porque quiero vivir esta vida feliz sin tener que sufrir, sufrir de amor por ti. Lejos de mí, lejos. Monsieur Periné is a trio whose stock and trade is a joyous version of Colombian sounds fused with French gypsy jazz. On their new album, Encanto Tropical, they spread their wings. Like on this track, Tregua, it happens to mean truce, as in a ceasefire. No hidden meanings today, just a lovely tune from Monsieur Periné. That's where we leave you on this election day. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Tomorrow, we'll unpack the results of today's voting across the country. We'll see you then. Vete, ya no te creo. Vete, no siento miedo. Empezar desde cero sin la ilusión.
PRI, Public Radio International.